Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Not Just New Movies podcast, the show where we review a seemingly random film currently not in theaters. My name is Ben Pearson, and today we're going to be talking about John G. Avildsen's 1984 film, The Karate Kid. Joining me is my regular co-host, Tyler. How's it going, sir?
Ben, I want to announce to our listeners, we were planning to release this episode tomorrow, but we're actually going to release it next March, so sorry about that.
Is that a reference to G.I. Joe Retaliation being bumped back?
I'm so pissed about it, too, because we wanted to do a follow-up episode to G.I. Joe Rise of Cobra,
right.
Episode 17, I don't know. And now we have to wait another year.
Yeah, and also we have to wait until...
I hope it's still around.
We have to wait until that movie leaves theaters, too, because the mantra of our show is that a seemingly random film currently not in theaters.
Currently not in theaters, so it could have been not new in, like, the fall, but instead, now we got to wait till next fall.
Right, yeah. It's kind of a bummer.
And I think a lot of people have been sticking around for us to follow up with that G.I. Joe Rise of Cobra episode.
Yeah, so just in case that wasn't clear to anyone listening, or maybe if you haven't been paying attention at home, G.I. Joe Retaliation, which is the sequel to G.I. Joe Rise of Cobra, which we talked about with Allison Loring on episode, I think it was 33.
Oh, cool.
Was set to come out on June 29th of 2012 and has now been bumped back to March 29th of 2013. So anybody like really looking forward to G.I. Joe who doesn't know that information yet, I'm sorry to burst your bubble. But
you know who's happy about that, Ben?
Who?
Cobra Commander.
Cobra!
All right. Well, if you guys are just joining us for the first time, we start every episode with a character name game, transition into our media consume section where we talk about what we've been watching, move into our review of the week, and finish with listener voicemails and emails. You can always leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566 or email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. And you can find this and every other episode of this podcast at notjustnewmovies.com. Before we mention the character name game, we should also point out that Vince Mancini from filmdrunk.com is going to be joining us a little bit later on to talk about The Karate Kid. He is busy prepping an episode of his Fraughtcast, which is the Film Drunk podcast. So,
man, I got a good feeling that's going to be a good interview.
I agree.
Hilarious, even.
Vince is always fun to talk to. So,
so entertaining.
Okay, so Tyler, I believe you have the character name game for us this week.
I do.
Why don't you throw it on out there?
Yeah, this week, character name game is Captain Mikhail Polonin. Captain Mikhail Polonin.
Wow.
Remember, we need a clue. The clue is a movie that has been released this past weekend, and at least six steps away from that clue. At least six.
Not the real rules at all. man, that is a...
Mikhail Polonin.
I can tell already that's going to be a super tough one. Okay, so let's go ahead and move into the media consumed section. I'll think about that name and try to guess it at the very end of the show. This is the part where we talk about what we've been watching, any sort of cool events we've been to, concerts, books, video games we've been playing, anything that we deem pop culturally relevant that we want to talk about. So, Tyler, what have you been consuming in this past week?
Well, I did rewatch Thor this week. Haven't seen it since last year, and I believe you asked me at the end of 2011 what my favorite movie of the year was, and I think I said Thor. Rewatched it. Still really entertaining.
Okay.
That Natalie Portman, she does wonders, I'm telling you.
Yep.
Could be in that comic book movie all day. I would still never lose respect for, as well as fan favorite, or should I say Tyler favorite, Kat Dennings.
Yeah.
Also in the film. She has not come on to the show yet. I'm kind of regretting that now. Why even start a podcast if we can't get Kat Dennings on? So yeah, Thor, check that out. You probably already have. If you've seen The Avengers, you've probably seen Thor. So.
Indeed.
It's
good to know that it holds up after a viewing of The Avengers, you know? Like,
yeah.
Sometimes you can, like, I'm guessing I could go back and watch Iron Man 2 or something, because that one always seemed a little bit, like, kind of hastily thrown together to me, and I'm sure you can see things in there that, like, they're trying to set up for the Avengers, but didn't actually happen that way. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, it was a little more fun because you kind of know what Thor is going to get himself into later on.
Yeah.
Although there's a buffer period, and I don't know if Thor 2 is going to fill this space, but there's kind of a plot hole between Thor and the Avengers. Like, we don't know what happens
right.
to Thor. So maybe Thor 2 will actually be a prequel to the Avengers.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah. I think I should write it. Another television show that's recently popped up on Netflix Instant from IFC and Fred Armisen and Lorne Michaels, Portlandia. Have you heard of this? Have you seen this?
I've heard of it, and there's like a famous skit or something called Put a Bird on It from that.
Yeah. That was in one of the episodes, correct.
So it's basically what, like just like a hipster show set in Portland,
yeah.
Right?
Well, I think it's making fun of that kind of lifestyle, which
okay.
is... Yeah, the core of the comedy is kind of making fun of these kind of weird things that happen in Portland, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
Because the very first episode, like, Fred Armisen, or his character, his TV side, comes back to L.A. and he's like, dude, I've just been to this really badass place. It's like where the 1990s has never stopped. Like, it's still there. And, like, young people work, like, a few hours in a coffee shop and have enough to live on and, like, pursue their dreams and, like, you know, nothing bad ever happens, really.
Yeah.
And she's like, where is this place? And he's like, oh, you know, Portland. She's like, what, Portland, Oregon? He's like, yeah. And so they go up there. And it's really bizarre because it's these two comedians. It's Fred Armisen and Carrie something. I don't know her last name. Sorry. Shout out to you. I'm sorry I forgot your name. But they do, like, all these different skits. But all the skits exist in the same world. So it's partially continuous, but it's also, like, the two characters are – you know, inevitably just popping in and out of different circumstances, but they all exist at the same time. It's just kind of, I'm thinking a little too far, but.
Well, yeah, it's supposed to yeah. be like pretty surreal from what I understand.
It's not really surreal. It's kind of absurd.
Okay. Absurd.
And the absurdity makes it funny. Like there's one where they own like a, like they both dress as girls and they're like super feminist and they own like a, feminist bookstore, and like Aubrey Plaza comes in looking for books, and they act real weird to her. And then there's one where Fred Armisen dresses as a girlfriend, and then the girl dresses as the boyfriend, and that's really bizarre too, because Fred Armisen, I'm sorry, dude, you make for an ugly girl,
right? He makes for an ugly man.
He's all right looking. I mean, he's not Quasimodo or anything.
Yeah, I have no idea how. How apparent. At one point he was locked down Elizabeth Moss from Mad Men, but they were married for a little while.
Rare.
Carrie Brownstein is the woman.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, Elizabeth Moss we could have on the show. Cat Dennings we could have on the show. Fred Armisen's definitely not coming on the show now that you called him ugly.
Well, I'm going to tell you a secret that I'm not going to tell Vince.
He's on the show next week.
No, I'm going to tell you a secret that I didn't tell Vince a little bit later on. Vince was actually the sixth guest that I tried, or the sixth person that I tried to get as a guest on this episode. The other guests.
We don't want to show our weaknesses here, Ben.
I'm just saying you're implying that like, oh, Elizabeth Moss, like, why don't we get her? Why don't we get Kat Dennings? I asked Ralph Macchio to be on this podcast. Politely declined. So
politely said, hell no.
And by that I mean he just didn't respond. So he would have if.
Oh man, you're pulling so many curtains away.
No, I know that's what I.
The audience is supposed to think that we know all these people personally. Have coffee with them in Portland, and then we're like, hey, you know, by the way, you want to come on my podcast?
No, we don't know any of these people.
Oh, so, all right, good to know. Yeah. Finally, Ben, I told you I started reading the book Live from New York, which is kind of this. Oral history through interviews of Saturday Night Live, and believe it or not, Instant Netflix has every single episode of Saturday Night Live able to watch from the 1970s all the way up to today.
Wow.
Maybe not today, maybe not the current season, but every single season before that.
Man.
So I've been, you know, reading about all these classic episodes that people have been talking about, so now I can go back and actually watch them, which mm-hmm. is really awesome. And so I watched a couple from season two. One of them was Steve Martin with musical guest The Kinks. Pretty mm-hmm. badass there. Steve Martin's, of course, fairly hilarious. And he's a lot different than he is now. And then another episode with Eric Idle from Monty Python and musical guest Joe Cocker, who I've never seen in real life before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he sings the Wonder Years theme song, which is a remake or a cover of a Beatles song.
Okay.
And... He looks like, I mean, I don't know if he's dead or not, but he looked half dead on the show. Like, at one point, he came in this, like, white suit, and he's got the jacket, and he's got the vest, but no shirt. So it's just like bare belly shirt.
It's rock
like
and
bare
roll,
belly.
Man.
Bare belly, like a really small vest, so his guts hanging out, and then a really small coat. He was like pulling a Chris Farley before Chris Farley was Chris Farley.
Wow, that is man.
Many Chris Farleys.
But a lot of Chris Farleys, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, if you're reading this book, or if you want to read this book, it's really awesome to read it and then watch the shows along with it, because that kind of enhances the experience.
Cool.
And I don't know why people aren't talking about this more often. Like, hey, every single episode of Saturday Night Live, you can watch like the Eddie Murphy time. You can watch the Billy Crystal. Like Billy Crystal, Martin Short, and Christopher Guest were pretty well known when they came to Saturday Night Live.
Right.
They were only on there for a year. So there was a year where it was just these guys, and then they left. And, you know, a lot of times people are like, oh, Saturday Night Live is where new people come on and become famous. Like Billy Crystal was already famous when he joined Saturday Night Live. Martin Short was already famous.
Yeah.
So it's kind of weird how many changes the show has gone through.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's it. That's about it for me.
And that's just like straight up a lot of content for Netflix hosting.
I really dig it.
It's like 30 years of television episodes or something,
no,
right? Or 40?
That's the kind of stuff that should be available. Like I always wish like the old Johnny Carsons were available so I could go watch. Like that's television history, and it shouldn't be like hard to access.
Yeah,
you know, as far as like people who are really interested in like old comedy and old television, like you know, old radio shows, for example, those are really hard to get your hands on because they got like people have them on lockdown. Like you can only sell them through certain places, and then they jack up the price, and it's like, why don't you just like nobody's struggling to listen to Gunsmoke from the 1940s.
Yeah.
Just let us study it.
For our New York listeners, if there are any in New York City, there is a there's like a film and television museum or something there that I went to when I was visiting a couple years ago. And it's like it's got an archive of like every television show ever or something.
Oh, nice.
And you can like rent it out, like rent out a monitor, kind of like if you're going to a library or something, and you get like your own pair of headphones and stuff, and you can just like sit there and like pick out like I think it's 5 different episodes or something, and like everybody just gets like the chance to watch 5 episodes of whatever you want. So I went and watched like Conan's first episode that he did on the old late night show, and like an episode of like the original Batman TV series and stuff. I was just like killing time there waiting for an interview.
I think that was the episode with the Riddler where he was in the bar and he started doing the cat dance.
What, the very first episode of the original Batman series?
Yeah.
I just picked like a random one. That one wasn't the first one that I watched, but
I know the first episode had the Riddler in it because of Frank Gorshin.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rest in peace. All
right, so
although he might still be alive, actually. No, I think he's dead.
Rest in peace if you're dead. So yeah, people can check that out in New York. You know, you can Google it and find out what I'm talking about. Okay, so for me, I've got a lot to talk about, but I'll kind of breeze through it quickly. I saw this movie called Akira. Tyler, have you seen this? Have you heard of this?
I've heard of it.
Okay, it is a 1988 Japanese animated science fiction film, an anime, if you will. And a live action version of this movie has been in discussions for years now with Warner Brothers. And at one point, Leonardo DiCaprio was supposed to be in it, starring alongside Joseph Gordon-Levitt. So I was like, oh my God, this is going to be awesome. This was like pre-Inception and those two hadn't worked together before. So I was like, oh, I love both these guys. I need to check this thing out. So, this movie is not available on Netflix Instant. I had to, send away for the disc for it, like old school style, and it's good. Really, really strange. Sadly, I watched it like more than a week ago, so I don't remember it well enough to be able to point out like any specific things, but it's basically about like this gang of motorcycle like bikers in Neo Tokyo in the future. It's like the cyberpunk type of thing, and
you're bringing me back.
And it gets like really interesting. There's this like Akira is like this being or something, this like psychic telekinetic being that controls energy in the universe. Like it starts out as like this this kind of like us versus them type of thing where motorcycle gang fights are breaking out on the streets, and the animation is beautiful. It's really gorgeous, especially like a lot of the cityscapes and stuff look fantastic, and I know you would really appreciate that kind of stuff, like just from an art standpoint, Tyler. But it's kind of like Blade Runner-esque, but a little bit more sleek looking, and it's a lot lighter. Blade Runner's like super dark, like so dark where you can barely even see what's going on half the time. But
I love that movie.
This
so
is
much.
Like a lot of lights, a lot of like neon stuff. There's like cool like light trails that follow the guys on the motorcycles. Anyway, I just, if you're into like anime, I would say this is a must see. Just because I don't really tread in that realm too often, and my interest in it was solely because they might make a movie out of it eventually. And now I just have like kind of a basis for comparison with that. For the kind of regular, normal, average, everyday film viewer who happens to listen to this podcast, I would not recommend this movie just because it gets super weird by the end. There's like a giant blob person who grows to be hundreds of feet tall and like super fat and just like sucks in everything, and like the world is at stake, and it gets, there's a lot of like telekinesis and like really, really strange things going on. It's kind of a profound movie, I will give it that, and if you can kind of parse out what it means while you're watching it and kind of put the weirdness aside, especially near the end, if you can kind of just get over the fact that it's really freaking bizarre, I think there's some stuff to get out of it, some good messages and kind of interesting kind of you are one with the universe type of things.
A lot of those Japanese stories have like spirit beings, like a lot of those Final Fantasy games.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of have the same type of theme where it's like, oh, at the beginning of the story, it's supposed, yeah, it's like good versus evil. You know, you have the regular workers versus a big company, but then by the end of it, you're not dealing with just like individual based problems. You're dealing with like universal problems where the spirit of the earth is being hurt by this
right.
company, you know, a la Final Fantasy VII. And so like that, like the company, the bad guys of the company become negligible at that point, where it's now these heroes versus a larger enemy, like a darker enemy.
Yeah, that's very much how this one is. So
right.
People can check out Akira if you want to. And yeah, it's a little strange. I also, the reason that this podcast is a little delayed, I apologize for that to our diehard regular listeners, is because this past weekend when we normally record, I was actually at the Hero Complex Film Festival here in Los Angeles. And Hero Complex, if you don't know, is a blog that's on the LA Times. You can find it at herocomplex.com. And it's kind of like, it's essentially the geek tyrant of the LA Times, where they talk about, you know, like sci-fi stuff, superhero stuff, and they get a lot of really cool interviews and kind of like really good access into a lot of industry people that a lot of other websites don't have the access to because they're associated with the LA Times. So they throw a film festival every year, and this was the third one. I'd never been to it before, but I went to all 3 days this year. Saw some really cool things. The first night was a zombie-centric night, so they showed Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead and Shaun of the Dead from Edgar Wright, and both of the guys were there for Q&As and stuff. Robert Kirkman, who created and is the showrunner for The Walking Dead on AMC, was there, and he was talking about zombies and stuff. So it was this big kind of zombie thing. Simon Pegg came out and did a big, as like a surprise guest with Edgar Wright, and they did kind of a Q&A about Shaun of the Dead. So that was fun. And then the next day was a little bit more strange, not as thematically connected, but they did RoboCop, which I hadn't seen in a while, and actually I liked better this time than I did the first time I watched it. Peter Weller was there, and he was...
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was like borderline... the old saying is that there's a fine line between genius and insanity, and I think... Peter Weller like lives on that line. Like, this dude is kind of crazy. He's getting his like doctorate or a master's in ancient Italian Renaissance art or something like that from Syracuse University, and he's a professor about, he like teaches about like art and all this like sociology and anthropology and all this stuff like that. So he just launched into, during this Q&A following RoboCop, which when everybody was expecting him to talk about RoboCop, he talked a little bit about the movie, but he just like went off on like the history of art as a continuum and all of these really, really kind of heady topics. And it lasted an hour. Like, he was just ranting and kind of lecturing.
Ranting or lecturing?
Yeah, lecturing, basically.
Okay. It sounds more academic than crazy man talking.
Yeah, no, it was super academic, but it was like, yeah, crazy is not, it's not like he was just spitting nonsense. Like, everything he was saying was like legitimate to, as far as I could tell, but it was right. Just like really bizarre in the context of just a simple Q&A at a film festival about RoboCop. And he just like I think the moderator got to ask like 4 total questions in an hour, because he would just give monstrous answers and just go down crazy rabbit holes and just do whatever the hell he wanted, basically. So
when I go into a RoboCop Q&A, I'm expecting an academic discussion of that magnitude.
Yeah, well,
I mean, how many times can people just be like, hey, Peter, I loved when you said you're under arrest or freeze,
right.
Freeze, scumbag, or whatever he says in the movie.
Yeah, but
freeze, dead meat.
You would have loved this one, because it was creep, I think, is the line. Calls
freeze, creep.
Just pretty great. So
any news on Super RoboCop coming out to theaters soon?
No news. Although Peter Weller, it was just announced today, is doing the voice for Batman in The Dark Knight Returns, which is an animated version of Frank Miller's classic comic that they're doing. And they're going to put that out in, like, I think movie form, like just maybe a short episodic,
yeah.
4 episodes.
No, it's probably going to be like one of those DC animated feature films.
Okay,
maybe like 85 minutes, 75 minutes.
Yeah,
and those are really good. Yeah. Like that's the stuff that people want to watch. And I don't know why DC is wasting money trying to go up against Marvel Studios as far as big budget films. Like, just put all your money into those animated things and make those longer, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think The Dark Knight Rises will be able to.
That hawk of shit.
Survive, yeah. Anyway,
no, thank you.
Rick Baker, the 7-time Oscar winner, was there. He actually did the...
5-time?
What's that?
5-time?
No, 7. He's won 7 Oscars. He's the makeup, like, special effects guy, and he did the makeup for... And kind of a creature effects for Men in Black 3 and like a ton of other stuff. He brought along an alien head with him from Men in Black 3, which was pretty cool. Malcolm McDowell was there, and he did a Q&A. He was the star of A Clockwork Orange. They showed that movie as well. And I've never seen that movie. Tyler, have you ever seen A Clockwork Orange?
I saw majority of it, and I didn't like it because of its gratuity.
Yeah, it's really intense. I mean, it's a Stanley Kubrick movie, so you know there's a lot like going on kind of beneath the surface. Like, that dude was not he would pack his movies full of all kinds of symbolism and stuff.
Complete utter crap. That's what I think. I think it's unnecessarily dense. Like, a lot of like the stuff where they just sit on the couch with like milk mustaches. It's like, what does that mean? It means nothing. It's just filler. And so yeah. Not the biggest fan.
Yeah, I mean, I still don't really know what I thought about it, because that was the first time I'd ever seen it, but I guess I'm glad I saw it on a big screen. And McDowell, who's 68 years old now, is still like super charismatic and really, he knows how to work a crowd, and he's really kind of energetic and engaging and a really good kind of Q&A subject.
Anyone ask him about Planet of the Apes? Wasn't he in that?
No, nobody asked him about that, actually.
Oh, that's what I would ask him. I think he played Cornelius.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, chimpanzee.
And then the last movie of that night was Super, the James Gunn movie starring Rainn Wilson. Have you seen that one, Tyler? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Wait, James Gunn, the fashion guy?
James Gunn, the director of Slither, which we talked about with...
Oh, that's right. Jermaine. Yeah, no, I really wanted to see Super, that Rainn Wilson and the little girl from Juno.
Yeah, Ellen Page. Ellen Page is fantastic in the movie. Rainn Wilson's also really good. I would recommend, especially people who listen to this podcast and kind of align yourselves with Tyler and I's sensibilities, to go check out Super. It's a little... a little low budget kind of. There's not really a lot of you can tell that they're working with a limited budget in the movie, but with that being said, it's also still really well done, and the story is really good. And it kind of goes to some weird places, too, and it does something really, really dramatic with the ending, which I liked a lot. So
I think it came out right around Kick-Ass last year.
It did,
which
it did.
It was kind of a struggle, I think.
It was, even though James Gunn talked about that in a Q&A, because he and Rainn Wilson showed up afterwards to answer questions about it, and he was saying that he actually wrote this movie in 2002, and it took him that long to get it made and kind of refine it and stuff, and he actually talked to Mark Miller, the writer of the comic book Kick-Ass, at the same time that Millar had come up with that idea, so they knew that each other was working on this thing, so they were both really cool about, like, oh, okay, it's no big deal, like, you're doing this one thing, I'm doing this other thing type of deal. But then, yeah, a lot of fans were like, oh, Super is just a ripoff of Kick-Ass, even though it came out like months afterwards instead of years, so there's like no way that they could have known, you know. It's like, that's such a stupid argument, but anyway,
well, those people are douchebags, Ben.
Yeah, basically. So and then the last day was a shorter one. It was they showed WALL-E on the big screen, which I actually didn't go see because I saw that movie recently enough where I didn't feel the need to go see it. And then they had a Q&A with Andrew Stanton, the director, Pixar god Andrew Stanton, who just directed John Carter, and that was obviously a huge disaster. And luckily, interestingly, nobody really talked to him too much about that. I'm wondering if behind the scenes they said, like, Andrew Stanton's people said, hey, don't talk to him about John Carter in front of people. That's kind of what it felt like to me.
John Carter got my money. I went and saw it.
I mean, yeah, I did too. But
job well done, Pixar god.
And then they actually finished it with the best thing they could have done, which was Serenity, Joss Whedon's movie based on the show Firefly. And then Nathan Fillion showed up for a Q&A afterwards, so it was really cool. I wrote about all of this at firstshowing.net, so people can go and read, like, full recaps there of what happened and what was said and what they talked about and all that kind of fun stuff. So
I'll probably include links to that on this podcast.
Yes, indeed. I'll throw those in the show notes. So how about with that, let's jump on into our review of The Karate Kid.
Hiya.
For Daniel LaRusso.
Is this the only pool you guys got?
The future seemed far from terrific.
This place is a dump. You should go back to New Jersey.
Hey, I know it's hard, but we're not quitters, are we?
Until he met the right girl.
She's beautiful. I say she's beautiful. I think she's beautiful.
Is that your address?
You got it.
But that only angered the wrong guy.
Country
club 9:30.
Definitely. You gotta be nuts.
And his troubles really began.
Dad, push it. Oh, nice.
Then, in one man, he found a teacher.
I promise to teach karate.
And a friend.
Fighting always last answer. Power, whole body. Make a perfect picture.
How do I know if my picture's the right one?
If come from inside you, always right on.
Joining us for this discussion is the head writer and co-founder, I believe, of FilmDrunk.com, Vince Mancini. Thanks so much for joining us again on the Not Just the Movies podcast.
Sure thing. Always a pleasure.
Awesome. So, guys, let's talk about The Karate Kid. This movie came out in 1984. It was directed by John Avildsen, written by Robert Mark Kamen. I'm going to list off a couple of his credits in case you guys are unaware. Lethal Weapon 3, The Devil's Own, The Fifth Element, Kiss of the Dragon, The Transporter, Transporter 2, Taken.
And, got a lot of range.
Yeah, and The Punisher, which I think is the Dolph Lundgren one. Yep, 1989.
Are those directorials?
No,
or
just
produced.
Writing.
Oh, writing, okay.
Yeah.
I missed that part.
Robert Mark Kamen, yeah, interesting dude. So let's just go around and give some kind of brief thoughts on The Karate Kid. Maybe your relationship with it growing up. Did you watch it a bunch? Was this like the first time you've seen it in years? That kind of thing. Vince, let's start with you.
It's interesting to me because in one way, it's like the ultimate 80s cheeseball. It set up the 80s idea of martial arts. Like, it was all this mysticism and like Far East crap. And then on the other hand, I watch it and it's just really well made, like from a technical standpoint. Like early on in the movie, I'm watching it, I'm like, oh, thank God, medium shots. I forgot what these were like.
Like
there's establishing shots, and I don't know. It just looks really good and it's really well made. But then at the same time, it's also like one of the most cheesy movies that you'll ever see.
Tyler?
Yeah, it's pretty cheesy. I'll give it that, but I enjoy that kind of stuff, so I guess, you know, that's okay with me. But I definitely did see, like, the cinematography where I think it was one scene where it was just kind of, like, pulling out, and he was on a mountain training or something. It was kind of like, just kind of, not a tender moment, but something just very individual, like he was thinking about something and just kind of the camera movements and, the shots at the dojo, whatever karate masters call their place of training,
right.
Hovels, something like that. Just, yeah, I really enjoyed the camera work. And of course I enjoyed Elizabeth Shue at age, I'm going to say 19.
At age hot, whatever
it was. Yeah. I like how Danielson looks like he's 12, and then he's like, oh yeah, I'm just dating this chick with huge tits who looks like she's like 19. looks like she's way older than me.
He's so skinny in this movie. It's crazy. I mean, like, seeing him, I think he was just on, like, Dancing with the Stars or something recently. Like, I've seen him, like, made fun of on The Soup or something within the past year. And, like, looking at the dude now and kind of watching him back then, it's so funny to see him, like, super, super skinny like that.
Yeah, and for a scrawny kid, he loves to get into fights he has no chance of winning. Like, that pissed me off to no end. It's like, dude, you know the old man is showing you how to fight. Just wait it out until – and he just, like, engages in the soccer fields.
Yeah.
Engages at, like, the Adventure Landing of 1980s. No one's going to pick up on that reference. That's where all the shitty arcade games are now, and, like, go-karts and mini-golf, and it's all – hasn't been renovated in like 30 years since the 80s. It's just a shithole now.
Yeah.
He's kind of a prick in the movie. Like, that's one of the things.
Yeah.
He's always picking fights. He's like all emo. He gets all weird and emo about stuff. He's always like, he's getting mad at this chick that's way out of his league who, like, just, he always has a chip on his shoulder about it. And it's like, dude, just, she likes you for no apparent reason. Just go with it.
He's like a stereotypical Italian gangster at the beginning, like coming straight from New Jersey. He's got like the accent and the attitude, and it's like, dude, you're like 13 years old.
Yeah,
you haven't murdered anybody yet.
You know how old he was when he was when they shot the film?
I'm not sure. I'll try to look that up.
We don't try to do too much research, Vince.
I was just trying to figure it out. Like, it says,
he
was born in 61. I mean, the movie came out in 84.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if they shot it a year earlier, he's still, like, over 20 when they shot it. How is that possible?
No way. That's crazy.
He was maybe, like, 17. There's no way he was 20 years old.
Right?
He has, like, malnutrition at that point, looking like that at 20.
Wow. Yeah, that was crazy. But you touched on something that I had written down here in that a former NJNM podcast co-host Pat and I were talking about when he was watching this with me. Elizabeth Shue is so into him for no real reason. Like, she falls for him so easily, and like he kind of juggles a soccer ball at one point and she's like super impressed by it, and then like she basically does all the work. Like, she hunts him down and goes after him, and he just kind of is this kid with like this, you know, kind of blasé attitude about everything, and he lucks into like the hottest girl by far at his school, and he just like doesn't seem to realize like the importance of that, especially in high school. Like, that kind of thing is fairly important, and he's just like, yeah, like you said, Tyler, just, you know, worried about initiating fights he has no business being in, like multiple. It's not just like two.
It's like seven guys. Yeah.
Well, I will say this, like, I mean, he does sort of use all of the principles of the game and stuff, where he's like, he always seems, everything he says to her is like sort of disinterested and like smart alecky. So he's kind of like available, but not available. And then, you know, he has this odd confidence where it's like, he seems to think of himself as like this, you know, as having like this high social value somehow. Like, he has this total misplaced confidence.
Yeah.
And, you, like, those dudes always do, like, do well with women. You have to – I will give it that.
Yeah. Maybe
get
Robert
get to the beach bang.
Maybe he was on to something.
Yeah, he doesn't need to, like, disappear for a month. Like, he doesn't even talk to her at school for, like, 4 weeks. She's like, hey, where you been? He's like, eh, you know, I've been around. She's like, ugh, take my pants off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Basically. And she always, Elizabeth Shue always plays, like, the spoiled rich girl in movies. It was this and, in Cocktail as well, the Tom Cruise movie, if you guys know that one.
Oh, man, when she climbs down that ladder on the boat.
Am I right, fellas? I remember the waterfall scene in that movie. That's about it. Oh, but, okay.
Yeah, she was in, in Babysitting, too, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I was going to say The Chase, but I realized I was getting her confused with Christy Swanson.
Is The Chase that one with Charlie Sheen?
Yeah.
I think I saw that on TV, like, 5 years ago. So the
good review there.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
It's got Henry Rollins and Flea, so you know it's got to be good.
Okay,
nice. So Vince, you're talking about a little bit about how cheesy this movie is, and I think a lot of that comes from the music. For me, the music in this movie is awesome. What did you guys think about it?
The music is awesome. The music is very 80s, but I don't know. For me, the cheesiness is more about just the depiction of martial arts, like before, when martial arts was still sort of like this mystical, quasi-religious, secretive thing where, you know, these guys could just have the special wizard-like powers.
Yeah, I think the TV show Kung Fu with David Carradine, had come on before that, and at one point, like, Daniel makes a reference to, like, what he thinks karate is, and Miyagi's like, you watch too much TV or something. So yeah, I think all of that was, like, right around the same time where that was kind of entering the public consciousness, is like, oh yeah, it's this thing. Like, I like how in the very beginning of the movie, when he first moves into that really terrible apartment complex, one of the first things he says to the kid who, like, introduces him and helps him move his stuff up is like, oh yeah, I know karate. And he just, like, he does nothing. Like, he studies it from a book and, like, you know, has no idea what he's doing.
Then you had, like, the Bruce Lee movies, too. Like, I guess those were fairly popular with the early 80s, late 70s kids, maybe.
Yeah, I guess
maybe
that's true.
The Grindhouse stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, I mean, Bruce Lee was, like, legit martial artist. Like, this was all, I mean, the karate stuff was all this idea where it was like, oh, yeah, you watch too much TV. I'm going to show you the real karate. Here, wax my car for 3 months and then become a black belt.
Yeah.
Well, it's like me watching Power Rangers when I was a kid and out in the playground just kicking kids in the face and being like, I know karate, what's up? Same dynamic. Yeah, Ben, mentioning the music, this reminded me heavily of one of my other favorite inspirational 80s films, Over the Top. Vince, I know you're a big fan of Over the Top.
Oh, huge fan.
Mike Hawk and company. Stan Bush, I think, added a few songs to Over the Top, although he probably could have added a few songs to The Karate Kid as well. It's just kind of that synthesized, I don't know, like Foreigner, Frank Stallone, all those guys, like, came out with the same kind of shitty music at the time, and it just so happened to be so inspirational that it pumped me up.
And the guy who did the score is Bill Conti, who's the same guy who did the score for the Rocky movies.
I was getting to that, but I appreciate that.
Yeah. I mean, everybody remembers You're the Best Around, I think, that scene.
Yeah, absolutely. That's
and then I think somebody coined a song or made a song, Sweep the Leg, Johnny, which is also a fairly inspirational pump you up song, the YouTube era.
I haven't heard that song, but I can see how sweeping the leg would be inspirational.
We gotta end the show with that song.
All right, yeah, I'll see if I can track it down. So we've talked a little bit about the karate. Let's get into like the tournament and that kind of stuff. Or no, before we do that, let's talk about the villains of the movie. So you've got Johnny and his, like, band of minions. And as Vince said, I think, you know, this movie kind of set up a lot of the dynamics for not only martial arts and all that stuff in the 80s, but also, like, the kind of stereotypical bad guy, like, 80s group of high school dudes. Like, this is kind of the best example of that. You know, you've got, like, the guys who just are like the yes men who stand behind Johnny and just kind of like nod and like pop out and like emphasize certain points
and my favorite line, I rewound it like four times, and when I was making my girlfriend watch it with me, and she couldn't figure out why I was like screaming laughing at it, where it was must be take a worm for a walk week. Like his face and delivery of that line is like the most one of the most amazing line deliveries in all of movies.
That was that's pretty good.
That guy's like chugging the muscle milk at like 15, and he's just like owning everyone in this tournament. And what was the line he dropped? He's like something about dead meat, and just the seriousness and the intensity.
Yeah,
could have gotten a hernia on set from delivering those lines. I'm telling you.
Yeah, my favorite terrible line in this movie was when Daniel's mom's car breaks down in front of the rich parents, and they like go to that kind of adventure landing place you were talking about, Tyler, and then like they encounter right when they're being picked up, I think. They encounter a group of like the cool kids riding around in a convertible, and like Daniel's mom comes and picks them up in this crappy station wagon, and one of them's like, "I really like your car, Mrs. LaRusso."
that felt actually realistic, way more so than take a worm for a walk week.
Yeah.
I was
waiting for the guy with the 3D glasses from Back to the Future to show up.
Yeah, was that the same? I could swear that would be the same guy.
Probably would be. Yeah, he makes a whole career just being a henchman in 80s movies.
Typecasting.
Can I talk about what I think is like the biggest plot hole in that entire movie?
Absolutely.
So he shows up. He makes friends with Freddy the Hispanic dude, right? And they go to the beach and they have this awesome party where they're like playing soccer. And all out of nowhere, like all these dicks just show up and break the girl's stereo, and like Daniel is the only one who stands up to these dudes, and even after they kick the crap out of him, he like punches the main dude in the face, right?
Yeah.
And then because he gets beat up, all of a sudden his new friends are like, "Geez, Freddy, where'd you find this guy?" Yeah, nice friends you got. And it's like, what? They were friends with him, and then he stood up to these dudes, and all of a sudden they were just like, "Oh, screw this loser, I'm leaving," and then they're never in the movie ever again.
Yeah. I have
friends abandon you if you're courageous, Vin. Don't you know this?
Exactly, clearly.
I have that written down in my notes. Ass kicked on beach, everyone leaves him underlined. And like even Elizabeth Shue, who he was kind of defending her honor in this scenario. Her friends were like, "Come on, Elizabeth Shue," and she's like, "All right," and just like walks away. Like,
this guy's a fucking bum.
I would be willing to bet that if it hasn't been done already, you could easily write like an entire thesis on Reaganism as reflected in that scene, like the values of Reaganism as reflected in like the fact that no one helps this guy. It's like, "Oh, look, he's a loser. This place, we're only hanging out with winners. We're leaving.
Stick to our own."
Yeah.
Trickle-down economics.
Nobody. So, yeah, no. So the U.S. Army karate champion, the teacher, who is, like, you know, super, like, living out his terrible childhood.
Vietnam failures through childhood karate.
I thought he looked like a chubby Val Kilmer. I just wrote that down. Throw that out to you guys. I don't know if you remember.
Aw, rest in peace, thin Val Kilmer.
Yeah, I was going to say, so you mean he looks like Val Kilmer? He looks like a skinny Val Kilmer these days.
Right, that's true.
Zing!
So, we haven't mentioned Mr. Miyagi yet in a real context, other than just kind of the wax on, wax off. What did you guys think about, what do you think about Miyagi as a character, and also, like, the stuff that he pulls off in this movie? Do you think, like, it's reasonable to assume that a dude who's that old could beat down, like, 5 or 6 kids dressed in skeleton costumes on Halloween?
I like that he talks like Bigfoot.
What, like brief grunts, like 1 or 2 word sentences,
where it's like no objects, like,
yeah,
karate here, karate no here,
right?
You come this way, Daniel-san, me make chopstick.
Yeah,
you know, like it's like no foreigner actually talks like that ever.
I don't even think what's the guy's name, his real name in real life,
Pat Morita.
He doesn't. He speaks like perfect English, doesn't he? Or he did.
I'm sure he did.
And I think this was like him breaking his own English for a stereotype. But I guess it was like stereotype prime, because I think everyone bases their Japanese old guy off of Miyagi now.
Yeah, totally.
You're gonna have to not say the or and we're definitely going to put a pan flute behind you, pan flute music every time you're on screen.
Let's cite Big Trouble in Little China, Vince, just to give some background to the Asian stereotypes that we're referring to.
Another thing with Miyagi that I noticed is, like, you guys were talking in the very beginning about the camera work and cinematography and stuff, and one of the things that I noticed, there's a long, long conversation that Miyagi has with Daniel about teaching and like his father and stuff, and it takes place, I think, in their like either I think it's at Miyagi's house, it doesn't really matter, but
his dojo.
Yeah, it's a really, really long take. Like, it probably goes on for, I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes or something, and the camera just like sits there the whole time and doesn't move.
Is it the one where he's drunk and talking about his war days, or
no,
when he's giving him his birthday presents?
Yeah, it was it was like right before he starts the wax on wax off training. So.
Oh, okay, that one. All right.
Yeah, just about like, yeah, talking about how his father taught him and stuff like that. But anyway, the point is, it's, you know, that was kind of refreshing to see, kind of the same way you guys were talking about, like, oh, medium shots. Wow, they don't really do that that often. I feel like longer shots like that are done more for like gimmick sake today than just like to let actors do their thing. So it was kind of cool to see. You know, these guys kind of just like sitting there with a camera and just going at it. But
it drove me nuts how many times Daniel's son called him Miyagi. Like, he had to be corrected like 6 times before he actually started calling him Mr. Miyagi.
Right.
Like, if that was me, I'd be like, dude, if you can't even fucking say my name right at this point, you obviously do not have the capacity to learn karate. So there's no way that you can learn karate if you can't even be able to say my name after having me correct you 6 times.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little bit more complex than that.
And then, like, every person in the movie is, like, keeps saying Miyagi. Like, it's like this running thing where, oh, of course no one would understand that it's Miyagi.
Yeah.
Wait, short G? Never heard of it.
Yeah.
I wanted to say something.
Go ahead.
I think these were the most important scenes where they were at the dojo, and it was just the two of them. And I know that's probably the whole point of the movie, but I thought that because they were the most important scenes to the story, they were really well done, and that's probably the best thing they could have done about it. I mean, of course there were cheesy parts with like the driving in cars and hanging out with people and like the beach fights, but like, you know, Miyagi lost his son, and so he's kind of found a new son with Daniel, and then Daniel's father is absent. We don't know why, but it, you know, we can assume that he's always wanted some type of paternal figure in his life, and so Miyagi kind of steps in, and you know, they don't come out and say it, but you kind of pick that up through those scenes.
Oh,
and there are a bunch of them. This movie's like 2 hours long, and you know, the kind of the goofy corny fighting parts make up maybe, I don't know, like 50% of it, and the rest of it is just Daniel-san and Miyagi just getting to know each other and kind of figuring things out, and father-son dynamic, things like that. So I really appreciated the movie because of that, and that's it.
Yeah, I remember watching this for the first time, and like Miyagi starting the whole wax on, wax off thing, and you know, me kind of being young and whatever, like not realizing how much Daniel is kind of a douche and like probably doesn't deserve to learn karate correctly. but like when Miyagi like, you know, gives him all this work to do, and he's like, paint the fence. Okay, you just painted one section. You got to do this whole freaking thing, and the camera, like, pans, like, really long around the entirety of his property, and I remember being frustrated, like, as a viewer, as a little kid watching this, like, why isn't he teaching him anything? What's going on? And then that revelation where that kind of revelatory moment where Miyagi like attacks him outside and, you know, tells him to use those things or whatever. Like I remember thinking like at the time when I first saw it, like, wow, this movie is awesome because I didn't see that coming. Like I had no idea what was going on. And it was, you know, it's a lot different now because it's like become such an iconic thing in movies for some reason, I guess just maybe half because of the cheesiness factor, but I don't know. I was transported back to my younger self when I was watching this and kind of like remembering the surprise and how like well done those sequences are.
That's kind of what I mean about like the way it's like the perfect 80s view of martial arts, where it's like this, you know, this weird thing that you learn like as sort of as a quasi as a religion, basically. It's like this weird type of magic that you learn and do on people.
Mm-hmm. and do on people, yeah.
Instead of, you know, instead of being like any sport that you have to practice and you know, refine and stuff, it's like, oh no, it's just, it's like this religion that you once you figure out this yogic mantra, you will be able to beat anyone up.
Yeah.
And it's a movie where you don't have to use karate to fight off like aliens trying to destroy the Earth in outer space or anything like that.
Yep.
Am I right?
So let's get to the tournament a little bit. So the whole movie sets up this massive tournament, and it just so happens to be timed perfectly where Daniel has enough time to learn karate and all that stuff. So we'll put all that aside.
Which really, a couple months, like 2 months, is really not, I don't know, it's not really enough time to master a sport that these kids have been doing since they were like 7.
Yeah.
To get a black belt.
And yeah, fight
expert level.
Yeah, and then not only that, like make it all the way to the final, and then win with a crane kick. Like
win with what seems to be a broken leg, and he just sweeps those people. Like he sweeps every single contestant with 2 months of training.
Yeah,
I could not figure out what the hell the rules of that tournament were.
Yeah,
it was like the weirdest rules. It was like one fight. Punch to the face is illegal, and then like 2 minutes later, it's legal again. And then sometimes you hit him, and it's a point, and other times it's not a point.
Yeah.
And then almost every fight, someone would hit Danielson, and then Danielson would hit him back, and then it would be over, and he would win. Like, wait a second.
Yeah, there would be times when like somebody would bull rush another person, and they would like push them past and give them an elbow to the back, and like sometimes that was a point, and then other times it wasn't. So it
was flagrant.
It was strange.
They do this weird scissor sweep thing to take them to the ground, and then like you had to like hit them in the back of the head on the ground. Yeah. And if you didn't, like the sweep didn't count for anything. It's so weird.
Yeah.
The scissor kick did most of the damage. You should get a point for that.
Yeah.
It's the one that concussed them.
And in the final thing between him and Johnny, like there's a ref in there, as there is in all these matches, but he's counting off the points, and by my count,
he was way off.
The movie was incorrect, but like with the way that they do that, I think somebody honestly like missed a line or they edited it out when he evened the score and then won, because the way I have it is 3-2 Johnny against LaRusso. So I don't know how.
I think one of those points was counted as a foul or something. Like there was a couple weird fouls in there where they didn't really explain what happened.
All right. Yeah, it was unclear, but I mean, ultimately it doesn't matter, because one of my other favorite lines in the movie is after Johnny has just been furiously pissed at Daniel the entire movie, like boiling over every time he sees him, and then he gets his ass kicked in the final thing after he's already essentially broken Daniel's leg, like Daniel still gets the better of him, and what does he go up and say to him at the very end? Like, you're okay, LaRusso.
Yeah.
There's no way that guy would be that like forgiving and like cool about it at the end. Like he would be plotting the biggest douchebag revenge move of all time.
Well, again, I think this is another perfect manifestation of Reaganism, where in every like mid-80s movie, if somebody was picking on you, you just had to grow some balls and everything would be okay. Like Marty McFly's dad, it was like, oh, he had some dude picking on him. You just punch him one time and they'll leave you alone forever, even in the future.
Yeah. That is.
They'll even be your servant in the future.
Exactly.
That is a good point. I didn't really think of this movie through the lens.
I like the Reaganism that's into this episode.
I think it's totally valid. Like when the first time you said it, I've been thinking about that in the back of my mind ever since, and I think it totally works.
It's in a lot of movies. It's in a lot of movies. Like I mean, like Rambo, and I mean, there's a ton of like super. I don't know. I mean, especially Karate Kid, especially the Karate Kid and Back to the Future are the ones that I think of the most.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, arguably like two of the most iconic ones from the mid-80s. So
were there pressure points involved that just magically healed his leg? It's just that boggles my mind too. Even as a child, I think I would have had some medical questions about that.
I don't know. I think Miyagi healed it by clapping his hands together and thunder striking in the background and him just rapidly rubbing his hands back and forth.
Well, in the mid-80s, they had the Japanese version of the Magic Negro, which was, like, the magic Asian guy who can, like, he has these magic spells that he can cast on you at various times without really explaining it. It's like, oh, Asian magic, okay.
Yeah, it'd be like Asian Bagger Vance or something like that.
Yeah.
Or Uncle, is it Uncle Remus? Is he the Brer Rabbit?
Yeah, yeah, that's going way back.
Yeah, that's way back in the time machine. Yeah, that tournament was, I mean, it's no over-the-top tournament, which I think lasts a third of the movie. The arm wrestling tournament is just out of this world amazing. But they cram it into, like, the last 10 minutes of the movie, which I think is kind of a shame.
Yeah, I almost want a little bit more of that. But, there's enough training sequences and stuff and enough fights where Daniel gets his ass kicked before he actually learned it. Where
they could have deleted that scene at the country club. That was pretty useless, and they could have put tournament time in there.
I love that everybody cracked up. Like, all of these high-class people just lost their shit when they saw Daniel with spaghetti all over him. They were just like, ah, ha, ha, like, pointing and laughing, like, comically overreacting to a pretty normal scenario.
Four people who were dirty were to be shunned and ostracized in the 80s.
Yeah.
It's called bullying today, and as Vince brought up, it's Reaganism of yesteryear.
Indeed. Well, that's kind of
psychologically scarring when an entire ballroom laughs at you because you trip and fall.
Yeah, and then, you know, it gets back into that whole thing where, like, Daniel, like, refuses to talk to Elizabeth Shue about what happened, so that's the point, I think, where he, like, disappears for a month, and she's, like, still willing to forgive him, even though he has to, like, go through her intermediary friend to like, figure out what's going on. He's, like, he's not even, I don't know, he doesn't even have the balls to go up and, like, talk to her about it. But
and I want to bring up one more point of super confidence that Macchio had. It was at the Halloween dance with his with his shower, like, self-made or self-propelled shower curtain, and he just brings Shue into the mix. He's like, we can do whatever we want in here.
That was such a baller move.
It was. Yeah. And sure. And also, like, that brings up another point where he, like, instigated an issue that totally didn't, he could have just left it alone, where he sees Johnny in the bathroom and he, like, runs the hose over it and then just decides to run away. Like, what does he think is gonna happen? Also, did you guys notice that there were car accidents after that? Like, he runs out, all these cars just, like, peel out and smash into each other. I was like,
I remember I said, oh shit, as that happened, because those cars, like, accelerated into each other.
Yeah,
it was just like, and he just, yeah, I mean, he instigated that fight, and so when he gets his ass kicked, it's like, well, I really don't feel that bad for you because you were kind of a dick. Like,
yeah, totally asking for it.
Again, who's the hero here, Mr. Probably Elizabeth Shue.
Have you guys seen the other movies in this franchise, like, ever or recently or anything? Because
I think I've seen all of them.
Okay. Do you remember any of them? Because I remembered incorrectly that the third one was when they went to Japan, but apparently I was just looking on Netflix, and that's actually the second one, so I have no idea. I know that
well,
the next
third one's body, got Hilary Swank in it, doesn't it?
That's the fourth one.
What?
I remember Hilary Swank being, like, bizarrely hot when she did the Karate Kid. She must have been really young, and she had, like, really big boobs at the time. And then I remember, I think it was the second one where, like, Mr. Miyagi goes to karate chop John Kreese's face, but then gives him, like, the nose tweak.
I think so, yeah. Man, that sounds vaguely familiar. I watched, like, all of these movies when I was a kid, and then I haven't seen any of them except for this one in, like, the last 10 years or something.
Oh, yeah,
so.
And then I think, Danielson goes to train with, like, a rival karate teacher who teaches him to be, like, a huge dick.
Oh.
So he, like, goes into a party and he sees some dude kissing on his lady, and he just breaks his nose in the middle of his party. It was kind of badass.
Yeah, that sounds familiar. Oh, man. And then, like, he has to go back to Miyagi to learn, like, the ways of good people again or something.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Oh, this franchise.
Does Lizzie Shue show up in all these?
I don't know. Is
that's
going to
motivate
Shue?
That's going to motivate me to keep watching the series.
I don't know. I'll have to check IMDb or something. I don't remember.
Way ahead of you, dude.
All right. Well, that's pretty much all I had written down on here. Does anybody else have anything that we didn't get a chance to cover that you wanted to?
I really like his high water pants. Those were awesome.
Yep.
Yeah. And I was trying to find this on the internet, but it's everything seems to say that he's like between 21 and 23 when they filmed this.
Wow,
and
that
he,
is amazing.
He looked 12.
That is psychotic. I can't believe that.
Like he looked well. Actually, you know, I guess we could just cross reference Elizabeth Shue's age to see like how old she was during the
her MySpace account and cross reference with MapQuest.
Yeah, she's 2 years younger than Ralph Macchio.
What?
Wow.
No way.
That is a hot piece of ass.
Man, they must have just done a nationwide casting call for the skinniest kid they could find.
Yeah.
Are you between the ages of 20 and 22?
Do you weigh 10 years younger? 92 pounds?
Do you want to get it on with Elizabeth Shue?
I like how they basically stole the plot of The Karate Kid for The O.C., where it was like the main guy was from Chino, and like then he goes to Orange County, and everybody's blonde and like a huge dick to him, but he's from the wrong side of the tracks, and you know, he's a hothead.
It's iconic, man. It's what happens.
The story is old as time.
Indeed.
Like the first musical cue, like where the bullies, where they like come in on their dirt bikes.
Yeah.
I'm trying to. Oh! The one other thing that I wanted to talk about is right before the bullies, right before he gets beat up on the beach, and he's teaching Elizabeth Shue to juggle a soccer ball.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, "Oh, how do I do this?" And she like knees it a couple times, and then she just picks up the ball and like punts it toward the ocean. And he's like, "Oh, I'll go get the ball." It's like, "Bitch, why'd you punt the ball toward the ocean?" What
yeah.
The fuck?
And she looked super pissed when she was doing it too, like out of nowhere. There was no reason for her to do that at all, and it was like. The screenwriter just wrote it in there like, oh, she accidentally like kicks the ball really far away, so Daniel has to run so Johnny can be with her when he comes back with the ball. But like that was lost in translation somewhere, and then, like they go from this really kind of cute moment of teaching and kind of playing around with each other to yeah, just her like turning her body 90 degrees from him and drop kicking it out into the ocean.
Like if she just hucked his hacky sack in the middle of the freeway. You're like, what? Yeah. Wait a second.
Oh, I'll get it. No big deal.
This must be how California girls act. Yeah, it was a really bizarre scene. I remember that.
Yeah, well, I also like the line when his mom's talking about her new job, and she's like, I got this new job. They said they're going to train me to be a manager. It's way better than working in computers. It's like, yep, that's a dead-end industry. You don't want to be in computers.
Yeah, that's like Richard Pryor in Superman 3 computer language, like just talking about like nobody had any idea like what the real potential of that was yet, but Richard Pryor's like designing video games on how to kill Superman with like no computer training at all. He just like happens to be a computer expert because he was born and like good at it or something.
Yeah. I don't even think he was born to do it. I think he picked it up the next day.
Yeah, they just said like, oh, you're a natural, and he's like a whiz, yeah. Like a computer programming whiz or something.
He's like, oh, really? Okay, well, I'll just program this huge computer then.
Yeah.
Two things all Miyagi men know, fishing and computer.
Yeah, everybody needs a little Miyagi in their lives, I think. You know, there's somebody to kind of pull you aside and get your shit together. But.
I do truly think that Miyagi was completely bogus the entire time. I don't think he really knew karate.
Yeah.
I think it was a stroke of sheer luck in this film.
And just a down-on-his-luck janitor looking for a kid to do work on his house.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's a shred of truth to the fact that he knows any sort of karate.
He was actually a slumlord.
Say it again?
He was actually a slumlord just preying on this poor young boy to get him to do slave labor for him.
I love
the
that.
Actually,
reading.
An opium tent.
Yeah.
That is
really
interesting.
He doesn't really teach him it. He teaches the thing with the hands, and then he's out like chugging around in the waves, and Miyagi's doing the crane on these perfectly aligned posts somewhere.
Theoretically,
he doesn't even teach him the crane. He just does it on his own.
And the crane could be like a made-up move. Like Miyagi, like the slumlord Miyagi that we've created, could just be doing something that he thinks looks like karate up there.
Right.
because Johnny clearly has no notion of the crane kick as a move, even though, as you said, he's been taking karate lessons for years. And you would think if he's disabled one of Daniel's legs, he would be like, oh, clearly the only thing he could do here would be the crane kick. And it's not like Daniel doesn't freaking Babe Ruth call his shot by mantis posing at him for like 30 seconds before he actually does
it. What do you think?
If you were searching the animal kingdom for a type of fighting style, I doubt the crane would be the first thing. Like, oh, tiger? No. Dragon? No. Crocodile? Oh, I got it. A bird. A bird that stands in water with really long legs. Clearly, this is going to be the way to learn hand-to-hand combat, is from the noble crane.
How about that crane that just got ate by the tiger? Yeah, let's go with that one.
Yeah.
He flailed valiantly before he was consumed.
The mongoose of the swamps.
Yeah, and okay, I'm kicking a dead horse here, which would probably be a more aggressive animal than the crane, the dead horse. Is that like we never see Danielson practice the crane either, but it's his like key finishing move in the tournament. So he remembers how Miyagi was doing it while he was struggling with the waves, like, I don't know, almost a half a mile away, and that's his killer.
I think there is a really quick scene of him like completely silhouetted where Daniel is doing that move as well on the same piers, and he's like really rocky with his balance and stuff.
That's right. Okay, I withdraw my comment.
Somewhere in the montage.
Yeah.
I didn't see too much karate, enough at least to convince me that he swept through, I'm going to say, 25 rounds.
Yeah, going to support our theory, when Miyagi gets to the tournament, Daniel's like asking him questions, and he's like, I don't know. I've never been here before. I don't know anything. And he's like,
he doesn't even know how the tournaments work.
Yeah.
He's like, wait, the point systems? I don't know. I just I hit the stone wall behind my dad's... brothel back in Japan.
I only wax cars and fish. That's real karate.
Seriously didn't expect this to be that huge of a tournament. Sorry I made you come here.
Did you guys ever see Collision Course, which came out like 4 years later, where Pat Morita plays him and Jay Leno are like buddy cops?
I've
seen the poster for that.
He basically plays Mr. Miyagi again, where he's like this wise old Japanese man. But then everybody's like always asking him if he knows karate, and he's like denying it through the whole movie. And then at the end, this guy like drives, is like there's like a car speeding towards Pat Morita, and he like runs towards it and does like a flying Liu Kang sidekick and like breaks through the windshield and like kills the guy.
Oh man, that's a Chuck Norris move. I bought a movie called Good Guys Don't Wear Black because Chuck Norris was doing that on the cover once.
Yeah.
I bought the DVD for like a dollar at a Walmart or something. And that, sure enough, that move is in that movie. So if people want to check out, like, if you have, like, a fetish for Liu Kang kicks through windshields, then Collision Course and Good Guys Don't Wear Black are the movies for you.
There should be like, a class-action lawsuit from nerds who got beat up from watching too many stupid, like, karate movies in the 80s that were like, oh, yeah, you just practice this kata where you, like, do these, like, stupid... like the back fist move and then like the leg sweep. It taught you like the most inapplicable, like useless self-defense techniques. And I know there's like a million nerds that probably got the crap kicked out of them because they're using these stupid moves, and all these movies were like, oh yeah, you know, just wax on, wax off, you'll be good.
Yeah, and like all the jerk jocks saw the movie too, so they know what the nerds are going to be doing, so they can like pick out their moves before they happen.
It's like the nerd playbook.
I definitely remember like in junior high or high school, like some nerd kid getting in a fight and like trying to leg sweep someone, and then basically just getting the shit kicked out of them afterwards.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh man. All right. Well, I think that's probably a good note to end on. So, Vince, I know you have to go record a Fraudcast, which people can find at filmdrunk.com. And where else can people track you down on the internet this week, Vince?
Well, check out the Film Drunk Fraudcast on iTunes, on Stitcher, or you can just find it on Film Drunk. And then, you know, Twitter me at Film Drunk. And that's pretty much it.
Cool. All right, man. Well, thanks for coming on. We appreciate your time. And it's always fun talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for it's always fun you guys making me watch movies that I haven't seen in a while. It's fun.
Right. Keep up the poop jokes over there at Film Junk. I love it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Good stuff. All right, man, we'll take care. We'll talk to you later on.
Thanks a lot.
All right, so Tyler, why don't you rev up the old Apple II, or will you?
I would, but Apple II, still taking a little vacation in the repair shop, or I like to call it the repair spa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, getting its cucumber pieces on its monitor and, like, freaking, you know, painting up its keyboard teeth and such.
Sure.
And so we're going to do another mystery movie, which we'll announce maybe tomorrow. I'm just going to announce it along with the release of this episode.
Okay.
So it's really not going to be that big of a mystery except to us right now.
Right.
Wait, we know about it. Yeah, whatever. You get what I'm saying.
Indeed.
It's mystery movie month, May.
Yeah, we got to finish out the month doing it. We've gone this far. We can't crap out now. So there's that. Okay, so if you guys would like to contact us or communicate with us in any way,
Kat Dennings.
You can do that. Yes, Kat Dennings specifically, if you happen to be listening. You can do that by sending us an email at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. You can subscribe to this podcast for free in iTunes. Actually, the way to find it right now is to type in geektyrant-njnm, and you'll find it there. We had a mix-up with our feed a little while back, so geektyrant-njnm is the current feed, so subscribe to that one if you aren't already. That would be awesome. Leave us a review there, because we lost all of our reviews in transition. It was a big nightmare. And you can check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/notjustnewmovies, and you can follow us on Twitter as well at twitter.com/njnmpodcast. We do have one new Twitter follower this week, and that is at @LindelofIsGod, which I like that. Lindelof being, of course, referencing Damon Lindelof, co-creator and showrunner of Lost.
That guy. And it's funny, Ben, because you were kind of, depressing us with how many guests we had to go through and how no one returns our calls. But we do have a large number of comments, emails, and Twitter messages this week. So let's go ahead and get started, Ben.
Yeah, you want to read a couple of them, Tyler? You want to alternate or something?
I can do that.
Okay.
Why don't you read the first one?
All right. So the first one is from Joseph Chase at jchase11 on Twitter, if you guys want to track him down there, and said, just wanted to drop by and say I love the show. It really helps me get through my 12-hour security guard shifts. I also wanted to give some movie suggestions for future shows. Time Bandits, which I've actually talked to Tyler about a couple times about doing, Joe. So
I hate that movie.
Maybe we'll get around to doing that.
I despise that movie.
Mystery Team, which I've reviewed on notjustinmovies.com before. The Phantasm series. Tyler, have you seen any of those movies? Weren't you kidding me? You were raving about Phantasm 2 like two Halloweens ago, right?
I love Phantasm 2. I've always said that Castlevania, if it were ever to be made, a movie can only be made in the 80s in lieu with Phantasm 2, which I think is awesome. Awesome horror movie. It's terrible, but it's really good.
Okay.
I've seen Phantasm 1, which is kind of good, too. It's not as good as Phantasm 2, but I have not seen Phantasm 3 or 4.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll give those a run one day. Risky Business is also another suggestion. Ooh, the Tom Cruise
movie.
I like
that one.
I haven't seen, so maybe we'll do that. And then Battle Royale, which is the, I believe,
Bangs
Japanese.
The hell out of the girl on that train.
Tyler, I think you talked about Battle Royale fairly recently on the show, right?
Yeah. Me and Joe watched that a few moons ago. That is a Japanese film I think came up with The Hunger Games before The Hunger Games were Hunger Games.
Right.
And and it's a really awesome movie. I won't
Chris
talk about
Farley
it.
Did, before Chris Farley was Chris Farley.
Chris Farley was The Hunger Games because he was fat.
Okay, cool. So there's that one. Thanks for the email, Joseph Chase. Appreciate that.
Definitely. Let me read one from our comment section, Ben.
Yep.
If you'll allow me this honor.
Do it.
On a little article I wrote a long time ago, top 10 Van Damme flicks. Top 10 Jean-Claude Van Damme flicks. Another guest we should have on, Jean-Claude Van Damme. Kaiser Saucy said, you have missed some really good stuff off this list. Check out In Hell, which is excellent, and sees JCVD turn in a good and convincing performance. That's not what I'm looking for, Kaiser Saucy. Hard Target, which we reviewed, me and Panther, here on the Not Just New Movies podcast, episode 74,
I think.
maybe 74. JC helps a woman searching for her father. He was homeless, and a group which hires homeless veterans for a manhunt is responsible. They fear being exposed and try to kill JC's character and the woman. Big mistake, which leads to serious van damage. I like the way they put that, so I'm going to support this comment even before when I didn't. And then there is the sometimes funny, sometimes poignant, and always entertaining JCVD, a film which is hard to describe. Just watch it and realize that JC's acting has improved with age. It's a very impressive performance from him, and the film is a real departure from his usual standard action flicks. Hats off to him for the performance, and this film is excellent. So, Kaiser Saucy.
All right.
Left a comment. Thanks for reading my article.
Yeah, that's a good one. People should check that out. We'll throw it in the show notes just for old time's sake. So we have another one here. This one was left on the most recent episode of our podcast. I think that was episode 89, Sneakers. I could be wrong about that.
You're correct.
Okay, that's all right. It's been so long since we've done it. So we were talking a little bit about Matthew McConaughey and John Grisham movies, and Leo, who I believe is the same Leo that created that awesome IMDb
for us. Props up to Leo.
Said, hi, Matthew McConaughey was in another John Grisham adaptation called A Time to Kill, which also has Sandra Bullock and Samuel L. Jackson in it. So, yes, that is the one we're thinking of. We're, like, you and I were going back and forth trying to figure out what John Grisham film adaptation Matthew McConaughey was in, and we did not say that one. So that is actually the correct answer, A Time to Kill. So thank you for that.
Let me take the girls' power ranking guy.
Yeah, do it. Yeah, go.
All right, hipster power ranking guy said, here are the girls' power rankings from the March 6th episode, Hannah's Diary, which I think is two episodes old by this point.
From the HBO series Girls.
Yeah. HBO series Girls by Lena Dunham, who's pretty awesome. We should have her on the show. Number one, Shoshana, fearfully honest and at times cute as a button. Also, easily the most likable character at this point. Couldn't agree more. Favorite of the four. Number two spot, Jess, terrible at her job and is probably a homewrecker, but kids suck. And at least she has honest employment. True dat. Slot number three, Hannah, the main character. Her morals are lost to the D. That D is capitalized. And she has no shame about the receiving end of sexual harassment. Blech. Come harder and smarter next time. And in the fourth spot, last but not least, Marnie, who's probably the hottest chick on the show. Except for overreacting to some petty girl shit at the end, completely AWOL in this episode. Do anything of significance, and I'll heart you forever, sweet, sweet Marnie. So that is hipster power ranking guy. Thank you for the comment.
Awesome. And then finally, there's a comment left on my Dark Shadows review, which was the Tim Burton, Johnny Depp collaboration that came out a couple weeks ago. Somebody says, does this person have a name? Oh, it's just the letter A.
Mr. A.
Person says, Ben, you're crazy. I don't know where you got that scary movie notion. I, on the other hand, immediately thought this was going to be a family comedy. I love Burton's dark side. There's something sexy, unnatural, and inviting about it. I do agree some new eye candy wouldn't hurt, but why mess with a good thing? This is basically just in response to me complaining about how I didn't like Dark Shadows very much. So points that he was this person was referencing, you can go to notjustinmovies.com and read that review there, or what the hell, I'll throw it in the show notes just because.
Seems if you like Tim Burton, we've reviewed a couple Tim Burton films on the podcast, one of them being, I believe, Beetlejuice. Is that correct?
That's one of my favorite ones. I like that one.
A couple of Twitter comments. Mr. Patches, an out of context comment said, I feel it's my duty to expose Katy Perry fans to the reality of the world. That was a piece of a conversation Mr. Patches and I were having.
Great.
Captain Kukles comes back and says, I never thought hearing a disembodied voice say things I've tweeted would bring me as much joy as it did. So, again, there you go. And J. Chase 11 said, I suggest you watch Cool as Ice, starring Vanilla Ice.
Oh, yeah.
I'd be very interested in your most likely scathing opinions on it. So, another movie suggestion, which we always welcome.
Yes, and I did talk about that one. If you go to notjustinmovies.com and search in the search bar for Cool as Ice, you'll find it on one of our podcast episodes. I talked about that in the media consume section.
And you can't deride Vanilla Ice too much because he did come up with Ninja Turtles Part 2 ninja rap.
Let's just go ahead and credit him with the entire story for that.
Entire movie is because of Vanilla Ice. Thank you.
All right.
American hero.
So that will bring us back to the character name game. So let's wrap that up so we can bring this episode to a close. We're running a little long here.
If you remember, the character name for this week is Captain Mikhail Polonin. Captain Mikhail Polonin.
Tyler, I've got to be honest with you. I have no freaking clue. Generally, I have like, oh, maybe it's a person in this kind of movie. I'm at a loss here.
Does the name itself point you in any specific part of the world?
Russia?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
And where do we usually find Russians in movies?
Submarines?
Submarines, that is correct. And
is it The Hunt for Red October?
No. Think more so of who was in a movie this last weekend.
Oh, man, that's what I'm trying to... That's...
Also kind of, sort of had submarines in it.
Oh, Battleship?
Mm-hmm.
Is this a Liam Neeson character?
Mm-hmm.
Did he play a Russian? In some... Wow.
Which might have had a submarine in it?
U-571? I don't know.
U-571, I think that's the Harrison Ford one.
No, that's K-19 the Widowmaker.
Oh. Well, then you guess the movie, because it's K-19 the Widowmaker.
Oh, okay.
So I guess Liam Neeson and Harrison Ford were both in that.
Wow, yeah.
I think I have my facts straight. Let me check one more time, but I'm pretty sure I'm right.
I'm looking up. Yeah, K-19 the Widowmaker, 2002. Directed by Kathryn Bigelow. Wow.
Wait a second.
Yeah, that's right. Liam Neeson plays Captain Mikhail Polonin. And yeah, there we go.
Wait, Kathryn Bigelow did The Hurt Locker, right?
She did, yeah, and Point Break.
Man, I'm getting good at this shit.
Freaking awesome. So freaking cool. Wow. I did not really remember. Like, I didn't know that K-19 the Widowmaker was in my subconscious, but apparently it is. So
yeah, I thought for sure that Harrison Ford's poor Russian accent was in U-571, and I assumed that Liam Neeson was the main guy in K-19 Widowmaker. But now apparently it was Harrison Ford the whole time.
All right.
I've seen both those films. They're really good.
That is a good one. All right. Cool. Well, thanks for doing that, Tyler. Let's go back and forth and tell people where they can find more of our work on the internet this week. Tyler, let's start with you.
SolarSandal.blogspot.com.
Okay. And you can also find...
And podcast.
Yes. Yes, running the podcast, as always. You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/BenPears. That's BenPears. You can find me writing every day at geektire.com, firstshowing.net, filmonic.com. And you can find my reviews at notjustinmovies.com, the namesake for this podcast. Music for this episode will come courtesy of the Karate Kid soundtrack or score, whichever I feel like doing. And special thanks again to Vince Mancini for stopping by and hanging out with us. We appreciate that. And
thanks, Ben.
Hope you guys enjoyed listening. If you guys want to shoot us an email or leave us a voicemail with your reactions to The Karate Kid, feel free to do that. And as Tyler said, we will reveal the mystery movie month movie sometime in the next day or two. So keep your eyes peeled to Facebook and Twitter and all that kind of stuff for that kind of information. So thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time.